Hey, Special Lady listeners, this is Jessica.
And this is Caitlin. Just a heads up, we recorded this episode, you know, before this week's event in Minnesota where George Floyd was brutally murdered by police officers. And this is coming in the wake of a lot of events similar to that this year. It's really easy to not know what to do or where to turn. And so we just wanted to give you all some resources, places you can donate and places you can reach out to feel like you're making an impact or making a difference.
Absolutely. And of course, this is just like the tip of the iceberg. There are so many resources out there, so many important organizations that have been doing anti-racism work for a long, long time. A few that we wanted to shout out that we're going to put links to in the show notes include the Minnesota Freedom Fund. They do really great work to pay bail for incarcerated people to get them out of the prison system. Any Black Lives Matter chapter in any city, always a really great place to donate for sure. Caitlin, you were telling me about the Loveland Foundation, if you wanted to say something about that.
Yeah, and I don't know a lot, but it supports mental health for Black women and girls. That's something that is definitely a good thing to be investing your time and money into. So if you want to donate there, those are some resources that can like reach out for people directly or to people directly.
And then, of course, the NAACP and the Southern Poverty Law Center, both always doing really important work in this. And I guess more than anything, we just wanted to say that this is a really terrifying thing. It's a constant thing. But especially if you are white, this is an important time to listen and to learn and to educate yourself generally and to act. But even more importantly, to remember people have been doing this work for a really, really long time. We don't have to be the main voice of it, but we can support it, which is important right now.
So doing that through learning, doing that through listening and just kind of just being present.
And everybody out in Minnesota, we're thinking about you. We love you. You're on our hearts and minds. Again, there's going to be a lot of resources, a lot of places you can donate. Those will be in our show notes.
And we're here and you're not alone. And I think, you know, no matter what you're going through, it's important to remember that.
Yeah. So thanks for coming here for episode 10. And I guess happy listening.
Yeah. Enjoy.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello. It's our voices together again.
No. It's been so long. It feels like it's been so long.
I think it has been. I think it's actually been. Well, here's the thing. So time has no meaning anymore. And that means that sometimes I'm like, oh, it's been 5 days or it's been 5 years or it's been 6 months. And I'm really not sure. But let me tell you, I had a very startling thought the other day related to you and the passage of time. So I was talking to producer Chad and I was like, oh my God, I think I'm going to gauge how long we've been shelter in place in Washington on how long ago we watched Love is Blind.
Yes, that was a lifetime ago.
It feels like I don't even remember it anymore. I don't even remember it. It was so long ago.
And everything was so new.
Oh, God. And we were like, oh, you know, we're just going to watch this show. And then by the time this show's over, we'll be about moving about. But we are not. That's not what's happening.
What's happening at all. And sorry, I'm just going to sniffle the entire episode because.
Okay. Poor thing.
My cats are going to start meowing. Because I moved some things around in here and all the dust came up.
Oh, God, it's the worst.
But, so that Love is Blind, I look back on that actually very fondly.
As do I.
Because what I didn't know at that time was that I would be moving.
My God, that's right. You're moving right now. That's bonkers.
So, listeners, I apologize for the fact. I'm not going to apologize. We have
no apologies.
Not recorded because my life exploded.
Well, your life exploded. My life exploded in different ways. It's been a mutual explosion.
Exploding. I wish it looked more like fireworks.
I wish it did as well. I wish it looked more like the pyrotechnics that we enjoyed at a Beyonce concert together just 4 short years ago. But instead, it looks a lot more like things being irritating.
Yeah, and like forgetting how long it's been since you showered.
Right. Oh yeah. My God. I'm really glad we're doing this. It's so good to see your face. It's you been too. Such a bonkers couple of weeks. Ay, ay, ay. I'm so tired of all of it. But I have no reason to be tired, it feels like. That's the hardest part of the pandemic, I think.
No, you gave me some advice. And sorry, my cat is also experiencing some anxiety right now. Hopefully the best thing is she needs to go on an anxiety medication and she has a toothache.
Okay. I really want that to be the scenario, and I'm all the way in for anti-anxiety meds as a consumer.
With Sophie, though, we used to be like, stop meowing, and now we're like, we're so sorry you are in pain.
Oh, she's trying to express it. Don't keep it in, Sophie. Don't keep it in. That little baby.
Yeah, so we hope that she's going to be okay. So yeah, sick cat, we're moving.
So much.
All sorts of things. I don't remember what that connected to, and I'm so sorry. It's okay.
That's just what this time... Oh, wait. I was saying...
Time.
I'm tired.
And sleepiness.
I'm tired, and I have no reason why. And then you said you gave me great advice about this, and...
You did give me great advice. So you had said that someone told you... So somebody gave you advice, you gave it to me, and then you forgot it, and I'm giving it back to you.
It's amazing.
Which is how it goes.
It's perfect circle.
But that, like, if you – that sleepiness is a – and again, I am sorry, listeners, if this is not true at all. This is one of those where we share popular science things, and we don't know if it's real or not.
Yep.
But it's a very encouraging thing to think about, and we can just keep it at that. But that sleepiness is a trauma response when you can't move, when you can't get away from it, you get sleepy. And I have been thinking about that so much because all I am is sleepy. And so I think that's probably why. So I'm giving that back to you so you can just be very kind to yourself.
Thanks, babe. No, that's a really good point. Yeah, it's like I'm shutting down. I can't face it. I can't fight it. I can't flee it. It's just all encompassing. I'm going to bed.
Yeah. Which is like, not to make light of it, but that's what the slow loris does. So.
Yeah. Hey.
Yeah. The slow loris, it just, when it, this is a form of a primate. when it gets threatened, it just kind of curls its head down.
Oh.
And falls asleep. Okay. So we're just some slow lorises.
I love it. I like that a lot. As I yawn, I'm like, that sounds great.
I was thinking back to when I was listening back to episode 9, I was so amazed by how you like kept the energy alive on that episode. And I think I had just learned. So like in the quickest thing, listeners, the bridge that connects my neighborhood to our city. Like 2 weeks after the stay-at-home order, we learned that it was literally about to fall down. And so it's closed. So now we have to drive really far to get to the city. And it's basically like suddenly we live an hour away from everything.
I cannot believe that the bridge thing happened to you. When you told me, I was like, oh, this is like a movie. This is like potentially the movie 2012 that I've been told I should watch because it's horrific and amazing. Or it's like every bad thing's happening. Like I was like, what do you mean? What do you mean you're trapped? I can't handle it.
I think we recorded episode 9 maybe 2 days after I found that out. And I was just kind of in this stunned, shocked place.
Yeah.
So I feel like my energy was just numb. And you were like, I'm making jokes. And I was like, I cannot contribute to this episode. And you like held it down.
Oh, babe.
It was good.
Well, today will be your opportunity, perhaps, because I am... Yeah. Fighting through some severe sleepiness. I am trying to put the pep back in my step. And, oh, man, it's a challenge. But I have a lady and we're not jumping right to it yet, but I have a lady I'm really excited to talk about today. So I'm hoping that'll give me a little more vim and vigor. But man, I am so sleepy today.
Maybe the lesson we can take from it is, dearest listeners, if you're also sleepy, that's absolutely normal.
Oh, God.
And I've been really getting hard on myself for sleeping in. And then every advice I've been getting from everyone is, no, it's okay to sleep in. And it's okay if your sleep schedule is really weird. Like, yes. I was like, I can't get up past 8. And I was reading, like, these online forums, and someone was like, sometimes people in my house don't get up until 5 in the evening. And I was like, oh, I think I'm good.
Yeah. No, like, no. I think if you can sleep in, definitely go for it. Again, this is not medical advice, but I know for myself, I have the opposite reaction where I've been waking up at like 4 or 5 and I'm working.
And I've been getting jealous of you.
No.
And that's not healthy either.
No. But it's hard because when I have a normal schedule and a rather like a much less crazy existence or wild existence with everything that's happening, getting up at 5 is like pretty typical for me. But right now I'm so tired and I'm still waking up. So what I'm trying to do, this has been my personal goal, is get up if I'm wide awake, get up and do something for a while and then go back to bed.
Yeah.
And like sleep for a couple hours. But like it is a fight for me to sleep in. It's really hard. And I wish I could, because like as I'm showing you today, I'm like, I need it so bad. But tomorrow I'm just going to like really try to let myself sleep. It's just exciting stuff here on the podcast.
I know.
Sleep
our
patterns.
Sleep schedules, our hair. This is why you came here.
Yeah.
Well, we can, you know, we can get into our special ladies to kind of wake us up. One last piece of advice that our friend Jessica, who also shares our Bayversary. She gave me this hilarious advice. She's pregnant and we were talking about like just getting through or some this time, and she was like, you always need to have a snack with you so you don't feel hungry, because like feeling of hunger is too overwhelming right now.
She's so smart.
And I've been taking that advice, and it like, because you know sometimes I'll be like, preparing this great meal, like I'll let myself be hungry so I can really enjoy it,
right?
And now I'm like,
No.
The stress of feeling hungry is like that little tip over.
That's too much.
Being stressed out.
It's too much.
And so snacks are so important. You can't be hungry right now.
Absolutely. No. And like, and we should also just like eat more all the time anyway. But yeah, no, snacks are so important. I've been trying to like, I get really focused on like the meal I'm going to make and I forget to buy snack foods. And so I've been trying to work on like, hey, just have things in your cabinet. May I suggest to the listeners, Pop-Tarts, real quick, fast snack, get a little bit of sugar in the mix, an excellent source of iron. So.
Who knew? Now
just,
we know.
Just waiting for that sponsorship to come through. Just really waiting. My God, if we got a Pop-Tarts sponsorship, I would have arrived. Like, that will be, I'll be like, well, Caitlin, that's it. We've reached the peak of success.
Free Pop-Tarts. Pop-Tarts for a year.
Oh my God. There's so many that are good. Okay. And as much as I want to talk about them, we don't have 45 minutes to talk about Pop-Tarts, unfortunately.
let's wake up with our ladies. I am so excited to hear yours.
Dude. She's so good.
Tell me about her.
Okay.
Well, we have to introduce the podcast.
Okay. Well, let's definitely introduce the podcast and maybe ourselves. If you're still here, if you've made it, if you haven't fallen asleep at us talking about being sleepy.
I mean, if this helps you fall asleep and that's what you need,
we're not mad. Welcome. Please. Then, like, if you need this to help you fall asleep, welcome to some soothing tones from the cast of Special Lady Day. That's our
podcast.
Maybe we do ASMR too. I'm opening something up with my hands and it's crinkly. Okay, I don't know what ASMR is. I think that's all they do. Is that right? I don't know. But spoiler alert, I'm Jessica. That's me and my name.
And I'm Caitlin. And I just drank some tea, so I'm sorry I'm delayed there.
Well, no one is upset because we're coming at them live from the Special Lady Day podcast, which is what you're listening to.
And we cover rad women from history.
We sure do.
And hair.
And mostly hair and Pop-Tarts. That's the new it's the new parts of their podcast that we didn't realize were coming. Oh, I like it so much. Hair, sleep, Pop-Tarts, noises our cats make. Yeah. Okay, I say this every month that I'm so excited about my special lady, but when I was researching this month, Caitlin.
Tell me all about it.
Here are the hits. Here are the hits. Here are the high notes of it. I wanted to cover, so I was like, I'm still kind of in this place where I'm like, I just don't really want to cover something super traumatic right now. I don't know that I have the bandwidth for it, but I want to cover something that's fascinating, like a person that's fascinating to me. And I feel like I sort of hit that sweet spot.
Awesome.
So I'm really stoked to cover this woman. Forgive me for drinking my LaCroix. They can also sponsor us if they want. Pop-Tarts and LaCroix.
I mean, it's a complete meal.
It kind of is. So, yep. Especially if you get a peanut butter Pop-Tart, because talk about some protein in there. Anyway, okay. Caitlin, are you ready?
I'm so ready.
Oh, mama, here it comes. I would like to introduce you to Rose Mackenberg, Houdini's secret ghost buster.
Wait, hold on. All of those words connected are so unexpected and so exciting, and I can't wait.
She's also
my God.
She's also called a spook spy.
Wait,
I can't handle how amazing this is.
It's going to be really fun.
We love spooky things, and we know we love spies, but really I didn't know that we could connect them together, and now I want a pendant of this. I want a poster of it. I want to tattoo it on my forehead and maybe have it on my grave.
Listen, all of that is entirely reasonable, and... when I discovered her, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. This is the most fun thing I've ever read, ever. I mean, high and low notes, as you'll learn. But, yes, Spook Rose Spy. Mackenberg, Houdini's secret ghost buster. Okay. Oh, all right. So I need to shout out my sources big time. I have three. Number one was an article called Houdini's Mysterious Girl Detective from the magicdetective.com.
Oh my God.
Every title. When I was writing my title, I was like trying to figure out, like, because I was like, I want to use one. I want to refer to her the way she was referred to.
Yeah.
And there's, as you'll understand from the titles of every article I'm about to source, everyone, I was like, well, that's good too. Mysterious girl detective. Like, I'm sorry.
Just list them all. We're here for it. We have time.
We're here for it. Okay. Second source is the Atlas Obscura website, and it was an article titled "The Female Ghostbuster Who Rooted Out Spiritual Fraud for Houdini."
Oh my God. Also, can we just say I want to come on the record officially and say I loved the Female Ghostbusters.
Okay. Thank you for talking about it. It was a fantastic film. I had so much fun.
Maybe I cried.
So much fun. Oh, I bawled my damn eyes out. Was I also sad because so many really, really toxic people got so angry at it? Yes, I was. But guess what? We're pushing through because that's what Rose Mackenberg would do. She's not messing around with it. So it's a full circle. And then final source. This source... I really need to cite. We're still on the sources. We haven't even jumped in. So this source is from the New York Times Overlooked feature that you introduced me to in the obituary section. Love it. And it was titled Overlooked No More, Rose Mackenberg, Houdini's Secret Ghostbuster. So that I borrowed that for my title. They refer to her that way. I also... really heavily sourced this source, and at points I'm like, I was like, am I reading you the article just out loud? And I'm not, but I'm not okay. Is the answer to that.
This is so story time with Jessica, where she reads You know, it's very popular right now to have celebrities such as yourself read things to children. So
sure. And we have a lot of both of those things with this podcast, children and celebrity. Yes. So gather around, young ones, to hear the tale of Houdini's secret ghostbuster, Rose Mackenberg.
Oh, chills.
Okay. So we're going to start with just a very, very brief kind of beginnings bio for Ms. Mackenberg. We don't have a lot about her early life. We have mostly information about her latter years as a detective. But here's what we do know. Rose Mackenberg was born on July 10th, 1892 in Brooklyn to Louis and Anna Mackenberg, who they were immigrants from Russia. Now we're moving on away from her younger years. That's literally it.
Very brief.
And here we go. That's all I could find. It was just like, this is where she was born. This is where her parents were from. Now we're moving on to her being a young woman. So as a young woman, she worked as a stenographer in a law office, and then eventually as a private detective.
Stop! This is so cool.
And we haven't even gotten anywhere yet. Oh, she's like, hey, I'm just doing, like, true crime jobs.
Because I feel like that's definitely, like, a classic detective genre, is the young female amateur sleuth. How did she actually... I did not realize that that actually existed.
Oh, yeah. No, she was doing it. And she had a case where a banker was asking her to look into a medium that he had gone to. Mm. And the medium had told him to invest in a stock that ended up being worthless. Mm. And so he's like, hey, can you look into this medium? Which is, like, kind of a hilarious thing to me, because I'm like, here's the thing about stocks, as we know right now. Who knows what they're going to frickin' do, right? Like, Except for mediums. But of, like, all of the things to be upset at a medium about, the thing that, like, you literally can't really truly predict, the stock market, that's just hilarious to me. Mm-hmm. But he was obviously upset.
Yeah.
So she was like, okay, I'm gonna look into this, but first I'm going to consult Harry Houdini, because he's already on a famous crusade against psychic swindlers.
Oh, yes. I had forgotten about that part of his life. Oh. So can you remind us, you'd said it, but can you remind me again what time period we're in?
Okay. Right now, we are in the kind of the 1920s.
Okay. So this is kind of like spiritual. Didn't spiritualism come in the Victorian era? Did it stay or did it ebb? And well, is it back?
I'm going to tell you.
Oh, okay.
So just hold on to your beautiful little hat. I know. I can't speak to the beginning, like the beginnings of it. But here's what I can say. And just really quickly, we're gonna kind of put a pin in Houdini. He does help her. And then there's more to come. All right. But this section I entitled, What Was Houdini Up To? That's the question we all have. So during the 1920s, this is something I got from Atlas Obscura. They described the apocalyptic tolls of the First World War and the Spanish flu pandemic. They say that caused a widespread revival of spiritualism. So yeah.
So are we headed there?
Back. That's where we're at right now, okay? Okay. There's been a big revival of spiritualism. And just for any listeners who don't kind of know what that means, it's the practice of psychic communication with the spirits of the dead, or saying that you can do that.
Yeah.
Whether or not you're actually doing that.
Which would make sense, like, if you think about after the Spanish flu, so many people have lost people suddenly. They want that connection. That makes a lot of sense.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, and this is actually something... that specifically Mackenberg spoke to later on at different moments, like right as World War II was occurring. She was like, it doesn't surprise me there's been another resurgence. There always will be, like, as long as there is war. Spiritualism is going to continue to come back for the exact reason that you're saying, right? That, like, there's so much loss. It's such an enormous scale, and people understandably want to connect with their loved ones.
Yeah.
And this looks like maybe a way they could do that, right? But of course, what she's very concerned about was, and we're going to make this real clear as I'm going to make this clear as we go through. She's worried about the people who are trying to swindle grieving yeah. people out of money.
Yeah, which is horrible. Basically.
Absolutely terrible. Okay, so we're going to keep going. So it spiritualism is this religious movement. It's centered on this belief that the spirit survives earthly death and can communicate with the living. And it was at its peak in the early 20th century. Its most famous advocate, surprisingly, I did not know, was probably Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes. You're nodding. Tell me what you know.
I just thought he was really into it, which is like, and that's the whole like big irony with Sherlock Holmes is that he was super skeptical. And right. so, but then you actually have this guy who's super into it. He was, wasn't Yeats really into it too? All sorts of people that are surprising. Yeah. Anyways. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and surprising because what we heard at the beginning, Harry Houdini was also very interested in it early on. He attended hundreds of seances, specifically trying to communicate with his dead parents. And eventually he decided that, you know what, a lot of these people that are saying that they're seers or they can communicate with the dead, they're actually just con artists, mm-hmm. right? He at one point kind of hinted that he might have occult powers, but then like eventually was like, okay, actually my stage act is just like sleight of hand.
Yeah.
Never mind.
I mean, it probably made for great marketing, right?
Oh, for sure. For sure. But okay, so 1924, Houdini's like, you know what? It's not enough just to like come out and publicly say, hey guys, I don't have any like psychic abilities. I'm not really like, these are illusions. These aren't, I don't have powers. I'm not lifting things. I'm not, you know, like it's not what it seems. He's like, no, I need to do more. So he publishes A Magician Among the Spirits. And he debunks a lot of the effects that these mediums are producing. So, like, wobbling wow. tables, floating objects. Like, he's like, no, I want you to know it's not real. And I'm going to show you.
Is that kind of how he elevates himself above them? Like, I'm going to increase yeah. my fame by taking kind these of. People out. Okay.
And maybe it didn't even seem so much to increase his fame as much as he, I mean, if you think about the reason he was doing it initially to try to communicate with his dead parents, he obviously had like very emotional, right. personal reasons oh, okay. for wanting it to be true.
Yeah.
And then when he was like, this isn't true. Yeah. He had this sort of like drive to be like, they're taking advantage of people.
There's like a protectiveness about yes. it. That's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. I get it yeah. now. Yeah.
And and because he's this amazing illusionist, mm-hmm. Michael, illusionist.
yes.
Because of that, he can actually explain to people this is how they're causing these effects. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's this great quote from him where he says, whenever any of these alleged spiritual mediums tell you that they have supernatural aid, he told a reporter at one time, you may safely set them down as frauds.
Ooh.
So he's not pulling any punches. And to further explore this, he decides to employ a... Okay. I'm sorry. This is one of the moments in the story where I'm like, how am I reading this sentence out loud?
I'm so excited.
This is so wild and amazing. And how has no one ever brought it up when they've talked about Houdini? Like, never heard of this? So, okay. To expose fake psychics... Houdini decides to employ a small army of undercover agents, referring to them as his own secret service, with Rose Mackenberg, one of his foremost operatives.
Oh my God. So basically Houdini's secret service.
Yeah, exactly that. He had
I love it.
20 salaried undercover investigators.
Oh my God. This kind of reminds me of like Game of Thrones with the little children, the little birds where they like run around and share secrets. Okay.
Exactly.
Into this.
It's well, and so this is why at the beginning when I was talking about this first initial medium case that Rose Mackenberg was investigating, she reached out to Houdini because she knew.
Yeah. Okay, and that makes sense. Because I was right? at first I was like, of all the people to call.
What's happening? Yeah. So she knew, like, okay, he's working on this. And then they meet and Houdini's like, oh, hey, you're incredibly skilled. Why don't you come work for me? Like, right. Come on over to the secret society of spies. What?
Oh, my God.
So amazing. And so here's how they would do it. This is the general arc, and then I'm going to give you some examples. The team would travel ahead of Houdini's touring schedule, and they would visit towns and cities where he was going to perform, and they would infiltrate the local spiritualist scene to gather evidence of fraud, right?
Okay.
Then they would pass this fraud on to Houdini, and then Houdini would publicly expose the people committing fraud at his shows.
Oh my God, I love that.
During his shows.
Oh my God. Okay. That has such a, like, okay, can I pause?
Yes, and just, please. Okay.
Nerd out, because like I'm reading the Poirot series right now, which also has a lot of like or just Agatha Christie in general. She's writing about these seances and things like that. And what Poirot loves to do, and I can see him for some reason, I'm like, he and Houdini could be in the same club of little detectives.
Yeah.
And he loves to gather people in a room and shock them with the reveal. And so I just imagine it's the same thing. Like, there's just a lot of theatricality and...
Totally.
Ugh, I love it. Sorry. Tangent.
Totally. But no. Yeah. Oh, it's great. Okay, so I'm going to give you a real specific example of how Rose Mecklenburg did this.
Yeah.
Okay. And they talk a lot about... she was, like, they call her a mistress of disguise.
Oh,
like, she
yes.
would... The first thing she would do, when she got to a new town or city, is she'd go to the department store and take detailed notes on the clothing worn by various local types of women.
Oh my God.
So that she could, like, pass muster as, say, quote, a rustic school teacher or a small town matron or a smartly garbed widow. Like,
where is this movie?
I don't know.
I want to see this. And can we have Kate McKinnon in it?
Oh, she would be so good.
I'm sorry. I'm getting so excited. I wish I was a movie producer.
I want to write the movie. So yeah, she'd go ahead. And then this is, okay, as an English nerd, I like this part so much.
Oh my God.
She would use pseudonyms that were plays on words.
Ugh.
So one pseudonym was, she loves a pun.
Oh my God.
One pseudonym was Alicia Bunk, B-U-N-C-K. And it was a play on All is a Bunk. And then my favorite was Francis Rod, or F. Rod, as in fraud.
Oh, my God. Stop. Stop it.
It's so cute.
Stop it with the perfection.
Like, it's so cute. She's like, hey, my name's Francis Rod. F. Rod.
And she's just like hoping no one notices.
Da-da.
I imagine her like signing in at the seance. I'm sure you don't do, but like,
I don't think really you sign in to. At the seance.
Little seance sign-in sheet.
Right. She also in her line of duty, before I give the example, she got ordained by so many different spiritual churches, always for a fee, because you had to pay to get ordained, that she got a nickname in the organization. They started calling her the Rev.
Oh my gosh. I love that.
I like it so much. Yeah. Also, my father, as you know, is a pastor, and I made a drink special when I used to bartend called the Rev.
Yeah.
And so that's what I immediately thought of. Anyway,
I know. Wasn't it just like PBR and Fireball?
That's right. It was PBR and a shot of Fireball. That is exactly right. That's what we made for my dad. But anyway, so that's a side note. But I just love this like organization. They're like, hey, here comes the Rev again. Like, oh, she keeps getting ordained.
I love
but
it.
Okay, so... So she's doing all of these sorts of things, right? But one of the main ways that main roles she would take on, she would pretend to be a grieving mother or a bereft widow, right? So that kind of leads us into an example of how she did this. Okay. So Mecklenburg goes to see a medium who I believe it was his last name was Gonsolas. Gonsolas? We're just going to refer to him by his last name.
Yeah.
And she goes and she tells him that her baby has died a few months earlier and she wants to check in on the infant, right?
Okay.
So Gonsolas claimed to her that he had contact with this 800-year-old Hindu guide in the spirit world, as well as with his own, quote, spirit wife, as he called her, named Ella. He then told Mecklenburg that for only $25... he could teach her to access the afterlife by gazing into a bowl of water. He then said, It would be easier for her to make contact with the Hindu guide if she took off her clothes.
Oh, no. That's
creepy. I don't know if that means, like, right then and there, but I'm like, really, give me $25 and take your clothes off. This guy is the worst. She declined.
Surprise.
Yeah, big surprise. But she goes and reports everything to Houdini, who arrives in Indianapolis, where this was, where this medium was, 6 weeks later to give a performance that Gonzalez attended. Now, I didn't understand. Yeah. One thing I had a question about that wasn't cleared up anywhere is, like, well, how did he know that the medium would be there at the event? And maybe it didn't matter. Maybe it was just like, well, we'll be telling the people that it's happening either way. But he did attend.
Yeah. Okay? Maybe he had, like, I mean, I can imagine if you get a special invitation from Houdini to go to his show. Right.
Or maybe it's just, like, so obvious. Yeah. Like, Beyonce comes to town, we're going to go.
Yeah.
Right? Are we a stereotype? Yes.
Absolutely.
Are we still going to go?
Absolutely. Proudly.
You're a fake medium trying to swindle people.
You're going
to
go.
Houdini comes to town, you're probably going, right? Yeah. Like, what else is going on?
Yeah.
But so he goes, and then Houdini confronted him from the stage, telling the audience about Mackenberg's experiences. Gonzalez mumbled from his seat that he, too, abhorred fraud and fled the theater to jeers and catcalls from the audience.
Wow.
Yeah.
So dramatic. Also, so that's pretty embarrassing.
Yeah, really embarrassing. Before I go into this next, her most famous case, I want to take a minute. I should have done this earlier, but I think it's important. There's several moments in my research where the articles would talk about how neither Houdini or Mackenberg had any kind of ill will towards people who wanted to sort of practice being a psychic because they legitimately thought they had psychic ability.
Interesting. So we have some nuance.
Yeah. They weren't saying, like, anyone that does this is a crook, right? Because certainly, you know, there was a lot of gray area there. They were specifically trying to root out people who were lying and taking advantage of people who were probably grieving, right?
Yeah.
So they're not talking about people who are like, no, I truly believe I have psychic ability and I'm trying to help people and probably not charging them money, right? Yeah. So they were like, hey, you know what? We're open. We just know that this fraud is occurring at a massive, massive scale.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's just like a little side note.
I'm glad you said that. That helps me understand.
Yeah, like they're not trying to be wet blanket on spiritualism, basically.
They're we just can't, like, have spiritualist wet blankets.
No, I don't know. I think very sparkly. But okay, now we're going to move into the most famous case
that
Mackenberg had. And it takes place in Congress. The year.
What?
1926. Congress is considering a bill to outlaw fortune-telling in Washington.
Okay.
All right. Now, there's public hearings.
Of course this goes. It goes all the way to Washington.
Goes all the way to the top. And just you wait. It's really going to go all the way to the top in a second.
Oh, my goodness.
So public hearings are getting chaotic as people are making competing claims on the validity of divination. Houdini is a star witness, and he shares the results of his investigations into spiritualism, calling mediums mental degenerates and cross-examining professional psychics himself. Where is that movie? Houdini cross-examining psychics in Congress?
So badly.
Like, where is this? I'm like, how is...
Yeah, I would watch that courtroom scene.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, but so Mackenberg testifies.
Great.
Okay. And she testifies specifically about a recent undercover experience that she had visiting Jane Coates. Jane Coates was a notable Washington medium. Now, in an article included in a 2016 anthology compiled by Tony Wolfe, this is recalled. Quote, "It was my testimony, brief and pointed." This is Rose Mackenberg, sorry. "It was my testimony, brief and pointed, that touched off the rockets and pinwheels and giant crackers of startled emotion when wrathful persons broke in with protestations and shouts of, that's a lie, and we never did such a thing."
Oh my gosh. So we have people storming Congress when she testifies.
They're flipping out. Oh my God. But what are they flipping out, Caitlin? What was in her testimony that caused such a ruckus?
What is the key information?
Here's a bombshell.
Oh my God.
She testified that Coates, the famous Washington medium, had confided to her that the proposed legislation would never be passed because her customers included 4 senators and because, quote, table tipping seances are held at the White House with President Coolidge and his family.
What? This is, okay, I want to call this Seancegate.
Seancegate! It's happening. It is.
Oh my God. So yeah, okay, all the way to the president.
Yeah. Like, so it'll never pass, is what she had said. Like, there's no way.
Oh my God.
I believe that it didn't ever pass. I think it just kind of got set aside. Mm?
Dang. Well, conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the New York Times reported at the time, quote, today's session was unusually disorderly and came near winding up in a free-for-all fist fight. That is how bananas this was. Okay?
That's insane.
I know. I know. It's just, I can't, like,
I love
again, it. Again, I love it so much. And again, I feel the need to be like, she's not mad at people who are ethically and from their heart practicing spiritualism at this time at all. She had been curious about it herself, right? Like, she had said, like, despite a lifetime of exposing these charlatans, she insisted she wasn't a non-believer in spiritualism and that she was willing to be convinced of the afterlife. Mm. But she had just never seen any proof.
Yeah.
So she's like, I'm really open, but, like, this is what's happening. And a lot of people are getting taken advantage of, and it's absolutely horrible, right?
Oh, my gosh. Well, this is, okay, this is, like, this is the plot of our movie, is that, like,
this is it.
She gets one case and she can't figure it out. Maybe it's a little spooky at times.
She can't crack it.
But then, of course, she does. But, like, we get some questions. I'm seeing, like, an X-Files moment where we have, like, one person who's a believer, one person who isn't.
Uh-huh. 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 I love it. Great. It's perfect. Okay. Well,
we're going to write this as soon as we get off this podcast.
We're going to, that's the first thing we're doing tonight.
Cool.
All right. So, a bit of sadder news. Mm. Houdini dies unexpectedly in 1926 at 52. Mm. Okay. But Mackenberg keeps working. She's taking on clients that want to combat fraud, including police agencies, insurance companies, and Better Business Bureaus. So she's working for all of those agencies, right? She gives lectures on how to spot a phony psychic and reveals the theatrical. I know, like, she's like on a, like, a lecture tour. Like, she's like still going.
And
like,
I can see she's almost like I don't know, who is it? Isn't it like Ralph Nader, who's like really into like consumer?
Consumer. Yes, yeah, consumer protection.
She's like a pre-Ralph Nader.
That's right.
This like 1920s lady.
Yeah. She also like reveals the theatrical tricks that she's seen all these fake mediums employ, like hidden harmonicas to produce ghostly noises. Ooh. Like, she's just like all big expose.
Yeah.
Right. Now, we kind of referenced this earlier, but when the Second World War starts, so a bit after this, right, another revival of spiritualism is ushered in.
Okay.
And Mackenberg is admittedly not surprised. And then definitely not surprised when it happens again during the Korean War. So she's interviewed in 1951, and at that time she estimated that there was, at that point, some about 150,000 mediums active in the U.S.
Wow.
And also, importantly, she noted she expected that number to rise as long as the war continued.
Wow. So it's pretty like this happens, and then inevitably this rises. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And this is, like, well before any of, like, the medium situations we've, like, fraud situations we've encountered in our century, right? Yeah. This is, like, fraudsters now who can, like, go on your social media and garner all these details about you. And then, like, there's none of that yet.
Yeah.
But already she's sort of, like, predicting this is going to happen.
Yeah.
So along with giving lectures and continuing to work, she wrote tons of newspaper and magazine articles, and here's a heartbreak, an unpublished autobiography that was called So You Want to Attend a Seance?
Oh my god. Well, our job is just to find that first.
It's my favorite title ever. So you want to attend a seance?
I love that.
It's just so cute, right? I don't know. It just makes me laugh really hard. And in 1949, a Hearst Syndicate article described her as, quote, perhaps the only woman Ghostbuster in the world.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Right.
I love her. So we're going to wrap it up. Rose Mackenberg died on April 10th, 1968 at age 75. She lived for decades in an apartment at 310 West 24th Street in Manhattan. She was a lifelong bachelor, never married, no kids. And this little fact is what we're going to close on because I find it so endearing. When describing her apartment in Manhattan that she lived in for all of those years, she was said to have kept it very well lit because after years of attending seances, as she had told the Hearst Syndicate in 1949, I get tired of dark rooms.
Oh my god. I love that. I thought it was going to be like, and I'm actually a little spooked or something like that. And she's just like, no, I spend my life in dark rooms.
I've literally my whole life.
Oh my god.
That is the story of Rose Mackenberg, Houdini's secret Ghostbuster, spook spy, lady detective extraordinaire.
Oh my god. That story had everything. And I'm mad I didn't know about it before. I'm so glad I know about it now. And also, I am so frustrated that we do not have a TV show, that we do not have a three-part movie series.
Right?
I want it all.
I want to see, obviously can't, I want to see Jimmy Stewart as Houdini testifying in Congress and cross-examining psychics. Like, I want to see that so bad. I want to see the fist fight that nearly broke out when she was like, oh, it goes all the way to the top. To the top! Ugh. Like, what?
I love it.
It's, well, and I just, what I really love about learning about the two of them in conjunction with each other is in both cases, they were people that were like, I was really open to spiritualism, or even like Houdini going to all these seances. Like, they aren't closed off. And I keep reiterating that because, like, I mean, I know as well as you people who do tarot readings and stuff now. And I think that that's wonderful. Like, that's great. That's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about different spiritual practices people have.
Yeah.
We're talking about fraud. We're talking about seeing people that are hurting and taking advantage of it.
Yeah.
And I think it is really amazing that they saw how this could be used negatively and they've just kind of made it their life's work.
To protect these people, because they could have just been like, that's some fraud. I'm just going to go do my thing over here. But yeah, they like made it their mission to protect these grieving people. That's amazing.
Yeah. And I'm also very surprised. I know it's a special Lady Day, not special Houdini Day, but like
special Houdini Day could definitely be a side podcast.
I mean, it might be a side podcast. Like, I never heard anything about that Houdini's work. And obviously it was extensive. He had 20 people on salary.
Oh my
salary
God.
He was paying. Like, I mean, it's just so amazing to me. And I love learning about her. I love how she never married. I love how she was like, I live in an apartment in Manhattan. I've just been traveling the circuit ahead of Houdini, pretending to be little old ladies or like matrons or grieving widows. You know, like it's just everything about her. She's a real crackerjack. I'm going to say it.
I love it.
That's what she is. No. Nope.
Controversial stance.
I'm taking a stance. She's a real crackerjack. I won't back down.
This is the hard-hitting journalism you will find.
At Special Lady Day.
Yeah.
Hot takes. Hot takes with Jessica Lohafer.
A real crackerjack.
A real crackerjack. Oh my gosh. What you're saying. So yeah, she's wonderful. She's such a delight to learn about. And
that's so cool.
Where are all of the movies?
I know.
If there are movies and I just didn't discover them, please send them to us, listeners.
Let us know. I would love to be wrong. Or make it.
Oh my god.
Does anyone have a camera?
Yeah. Listen, you got a phone. Get out there. Film it.
That's Oh my gosh.
Yeah. That's the story. And I'm sticking to it.
I love it. I'll let, you know, when I'm in a bad mood, I'm going to imagine her.
Oh.
Just detecting.
Just detecting. Just out there. Oh, just out there letting her mind do the work.
I love you know? It. Let your mind do the work.
I'm going to keep bringing that back every episode.
How can we squeeze, fit that into every episode? No, this is awesome.
I think it'll be easy. Okay, Caitlin. But now I get to hear about your specialist lady of all time. I'm so excited to hear about this lady.
I'm excited too. I'm feeling nervous. I'm feeling...
What? No.
There's so much about this person.
Okay.
And...
Oh my God.
So many weird, quirky things that I was like, that doesn't really need to be in there. But I'm like, it's so weird and interesting that I want it in there. Okay. Not quite the same as your special lady from last time, where it's like kind of these all over the map.
Mm-hmm.
But just kind of interesting anecdotes that all put it all together and it becomes this person, which I actually think is a great metaphor. So my script is kind of it's a hodgepodge. And I think hodgepodge is a great way to describe this person.
I love it.
For example, I was like, I could introduce her in about 3 different ways.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know how to do it. So I'm just going to give them all to you in different, in a different order. Okay. So here's why I was thinking about her. So with the shelter in place or the stay at home orders, like, kind of like they influenced yours, I've just been thinking a lot about some of my favorite places in the world that I've been because I can't go. So this is another this is another imagination station with Caitlin. Oh,
I love imagination station with Caitlin.
Yeah. And so I wanted, and this is really why I thought of this person. I am going to tell you about the woman who created and envisioned one of my top locations on planet Earth.
What?
Yes. I am going to tell you about Isabella Stewart Gardner, the art matron of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. Yes.
I'm just really excited. I don't know anything about her. Sorry.
That was okay. I was like, oh my God, have you been there? No. So this museum has been called a house of art and also a thought palace, which Sherlock Holmes' connection, you know how he, I don't know if this is actually, I can't remember if it's in the stories, but in the BBC show, he always goes to his mind palace to like solve his crimes. So this museum is kind of this externalization of this woman's mind, of Isabella Stewart Gardner's mind, and it's amazing. Oh, and so this is the other way I could start. I first encountered Isabella Stewart Gardner when I was a young, sad teen, Caitlin, living in Boston for the first year of college, and I was feeling homesick and not very happy, and I had just had my heart broken, and it was so cold. And so the first teaching job I ever had, which was it was like a work volunteer, like we got paid from the school to volunteer at this school, and I would pass this museum on my way to the school, and one of my friends was studying art history at Boston College, and she was like, you have to go check out this crazy weird museum with this like funky lady who just put all these things in all these different places. And I went there and really experienced this sense of like awe and life and aliveness that I needed, and ended up returning to the museum many, many times while I lived there, sometimes with a friend and sometimes by myself, just to kind of just to experience like beauty and grace and wonder and awe. And so this place became like a very important place for me when I was not feeling so great. And the good news is I moved away from there and had an amazing the rest is history and life was great, but it really got me through that hard time. So that's how I kind of came to know her, and I'm just going to try to describe a lot of things that I think are indescribable, so heads up. It's just like I'm going to give you the best storytelling picture I can.
You're already doing it.
So she was a woman of drive and very specific vision that created this kind of palace and museum that was this, as I said before, this externalized space that kind of was her mind. Here's a little quote to start us off from 1917. She said, "Years ago, I decided the greatest need in our country was art. So I was determined to make my life work if I could." Another little quote from a Boston reporter. Sometimes she was called, and at this time it was like cute and quirky and spunky, but it kind of annoys me. But a lot of people call her that, and I want to like honor the way she was called. But people would call her Mrs. Jack Gardner because that was her husband's name. And so they were like, it's cute, we'll call her Mrs. Jack. That's a guy's name. But I'm also like, but she has a real name.
Right.
But anyways, right. At the time they were like, what a cute little nickname. So anyways, Mrs. Jack Gardner is one of the seven wonders of Boston. There is no one like her in the city, in any city in this country. She is a millionaire bohemian. She is the leader of the smart set, but she often leads where none dare follow. She imitates nobody. Everything she does is novel and original.
Oh, I just got chills all the way. Oh my God.
Yeah. So wow. She is fascinating. And I'm going to give you as much as I can. Okay. And the thing I love about this too is that there are like a couple really big biographies of her, and every other biographer hates the other biography. And and one is like, oh, that's just some gossip, or like, oh, this is so. Anyways,
scandal.
I feel like there's palace no intrigue. One definitive source. So a article I used heavily, and here's just a wonderful article title to kind of go with a theme for today. It's from Vice by Liz Lintz, and I'll quote her quite a bit because she has some really interesting quotes. It's called "The Scandalous Legacy of Isabella Stewart Gardner, Collector of Art and Men." Which I love. And I also got information from, you know, biography.com, Britannica, and also the Wallace Foundation and the Boston Women's Heritage Museum. And before we get started, I just kind of want to make a note that we are talking about art collection. And that is kind of a career and pursuit, especially, you know, even now, that when you look at, like, the Western world collecting art from other parts of the world, it is inherently tied with imperialism and Orientalism and all of those things. Yep. And, you know, I can think of, like, the biggest example is, like, the Elgin marbles in the British Museum, which are the marble statues from the Acropolis that still haven't been given back to Greece. And it's very interesting. I remember, like, I've been to the Acropolis where they're like, give us back the Elgin marbles. And then going to the British Museum, and they have these pamphlets even before you get inside that is like, this is why we have the Elgin marbles. And this is why. And yeah. And so it's very, this stuff isn't over in terms of controversy or resolution. And there are a lot of intense feelings on all sides. And so I don't want to shy away from that at all. And that definitely clouds her whole life's project. But I think it's still worth talking about because there's so much interesting stuff there. And she broke a lot of these societal rules and boundaries of the time. Mm. But I don't want to ignore that. That's just kind of inherent in what we're doing.
Duly noted. Thank you.
Yeah. So anyways, her, and also, you know, just not, her life is full of privilege. She is like one of the wealthy elite. But that said, I don't think it's a reason not to cover her.
Of course.
But she had access to a lot of things that many people at the time didn't. So she was born in New York City, another New York lady for this episode, on April 14th in 1840. So she kind of takes us through the Civil War to the Victorian period, and then that kind of turn of the century, beginning of the 19th century. Her family was very wealthy. Her father, David Stewart, made his fortune in importing Irish linen and then through some investments. And if Stewart sounds familiar, it's because she had paternal Scottish ancestry through that royal Stewart line. So Outlander fans, this is your plot of Outlander. Shakespeare fans, this is the Scottish king that gave you Macbeth. So she has this like lineage to all these like crazy parts of history, and she was very proud of that. So she has this life of she's already in this kind of like royal wealthy family line, but it's really mixed with a lot of tragedy. She's the eldest of four children, and she was the only one to survive adulthood.
Oh my gosh.
To adulthood. And so she was extremely doted upon because of this. The entire family had experienced all these losses.
It's terrible.
Yeah. So she was extremely doted upon, but she was also very spirited as a child, and she got into trouble very frequently. Mm-hmm. And this is a nice example of this. Once when she was younger, she tried to run off to watch the circus, which was kind of unladylike. And she had to be dragged back home by a servant sobbing. So she's like, what is this magical world out here? And yeah, they were like, no, you're a pedigreed lady. You cannot go see the circus. And so, yes. And just to kind of continue with that, she was privately educated in New York and then quote unquote finished abroad, which is, I guess, what happens to women, which sounds
awful, but I bet it was nice.
Yeah. But nice. She did. So this time abroad, though, she went to Europe, of course, because that's where they would send young ladies abroad to get cultured, quote unquote. And she really, you know, this trip really nurtured and kind of started this lifelong passion of hers that was the arts. So, you know, she would kind of travel around Europe, going to museums and things like that. So even though it is pretty stuffy, it really kind of ignited this lifelong interest for her.
Right.
In Paris, of course, she's like traveling around the world. And that's also, you know, like, yes, women traveled. Maybe it was okay to go to Paris, but even Paris was like, scandalous. And she kind of took that those traveling boundaries and went all over the world. So, you know, we think, like, that's a pretty privileged thing to do now, but especially for like a Victorian woman, it was kind of like, what are you doing going to these countries and getting your, you know, it was very unusual to have this passion for going abroad. Romantic. So anyways, one of her schoolmates in Paris, Julia Gardner, introduced Isabella to her brother, John, a.k.a. Jack Lowell Gardner Jr. And in 1860, a few days before her 20th birthday, Isabella Stewart married Jack Gardner in Grace Church in Manhattan. So that's like that church right by Washington Square Park.
Wow.
Yeah. So they were married there. So she already... Her life is glamorous and
super
fun.
Glam.
But I just love it because everywhere you turn, you're like, Isabella Stewart Gardner did something really fun here.
here.
So they moved to his hometown, which was Boston. So kind of unlike New York, Boston was very, it has this heritage of like the Puritans. And I know I'm really sweeping over a lot of that. And I know you have a lot of experience with like the New England literary history.
I just love me some Puritan knowledge. Shout out to Laura Lafredo.
I know, right? So they were, you know, New York City even was like, ooh, you're from New York. Those crazy people. Boston was a bit buttoned up. So they settled in this very fashionable neighborhood called Back Bay at 152 Beacon Street, which was this house that it was given to them as a wedding gift. Wouldn't that be nice?
Sure.
And Back Bay is this older neighborhood. It's all these rows and rows of very fancy houses. And I remember from my time in Boston, going to like a party in one of those houses, and the guy who owned it, not only was he this like heir to this giant fortune, but he was like, look at these elevators. They're the same elevators that were in the Titanic.
What?
Yeah, or like the same make and model and whatever.
Anyways,
this is like the fancy area. So
that's a really nice song.
Thank you. So she lived in the fashionable neighborhood. It's still the fashionable neighborhood.
Old money.
But even though she really adopted the city as her own, and also she came from more like a royal Scottish lineage. The Boston Brahmin, as they were called, this like elite Boston stuffiness central society, did not reciprocate this openness.
Okay, hold on a second. She sounds like a charming young person.
They're like, too charming.
too much charm. Yeah. Look at you wanting to see places. Who do you think you are, a man?
Yeah, they're like, your place is in the home and staring at nowhere because you can't even look at the legs of a table because it's the Victorian era.
That's right. Be racy.
Yeah. Okay. So they did not. So anyways, she kind of started to develop this kind of sensitivity to other people who felt alienated. And particularly artists. And so we'll kind of come back to that. But already she's looking at these kind of outsider groups and really feeling an affinity with them. And so tragedy strikes their young family. In 1863, the Gardners had a son called Jackie, and he died at the age of 2 years old. So it was really awful. And then two more tragedies follow. Her sister-in-law dies in childbirth. And then Gardner herself suffered a near fatal miscarriage pretty soon afterwards. And so she just fell into this deep, deep bout of depression. And so on the advice of a doctor, kind of hoping to rouse her depression, Jack and Isabella went on this like kind of round the world trip through Northern Europe and Russia. And the stories go that, like, she was in such a deep throes of depression that she had to be carried onto the ship on a mattress. Oh, she just, like, couldn't walk.
Oh, yeah. So heartbreaking.
Yeah, so really rough. But the good news is the travel and her trips abroad really kind of rekindled her spirit. And this was the first of many trips around the world, including Egypt and the Middle East and Asia. And she kept elaborate travel journals, and much of her recovery had to do with the art that she was experiencing abroad, which is really cool. So she spent a lot of time in Italy. And so this had kind of started when she was a young girl. And then now, as she's going around and kind of becoming rejuvenated and getting this second chance at life from art, it becomes like art is her lifeline and the object of her devotion completely. She lives and breathes it. And so this kind of comes in later, but around that same trip, Isabella and Jack Gardner visit the Palazzo Barbaro, a Venetian palace that these Bostonians owned. And the Palazzo kind of became this gathering place for expats, American and English expats, including, and this is kind of important because he shows up again, but the painter John Singer Sargent, James McNeil Whistler, like, you know, Whistler's mother, Ralph Curtis, and also the art connoisseur Bernard Brunson, who will come back later. So this became, the Palazzo Barbaro becomes a big inspiration for her museum later on. So just hold on to that thought.
Okay, I'm putting it in my pocket.
Put it in your pocket, yeah. So she returns to Boston in 1868, a changed woman. And this is where, like, she becomes that cutesy Miss Jack that still kind of annoys me, but I'm gonna respect it.
right.
So she began throwing some parties. She's like, yes. I have another, you know, I am full of life again. I'm full of the life of art, and we are going to have some fun. And I love this quote, and I'm so sorry, I forget where I got it from, but she dazzled and occasionally titillated conservative Boston.
Oh my.
So
here
are a couple of the little things she got up to. So she got her dresses from Paris, which was considered way too revealing and scandalous. And in a famous moment, a man tried to insult her by saying, "Pray, who undressed you?" And she replied, "Worth," which is this like innovative Parisian dressmaker of the time. If you had a Worth dress,
it was like, that was the end all.
So it'd be like, "Who dressed you?" I don't know. I can't think of a famous designer because I don't wear those clothes. But, you know, just be like Rihanna. I don't know.
Rihanna is the brand.
Just Rihanna. I mean,
yeah.
Anyways, and so this is a quote from that Vice article by Liz Lintz. Isabella smoked cigarettes, and the newspaper ran stories claiming she had taken zoo lions for a stroll in the park.
My God.
A dahlia bears her name, and so does a peak in Washington, which I had no idea.
What? Washington State?
Yeah. Yeah. What? Like a mountain peak is named after her, and like no idea why. This is just the things that she, this is the crazy stuff that I'm like, I can't leave it out. I don't know
how. No, I mean, how do you get your own mountain?
And also, questions. She also has her own flower. Oh, yeah, we said that. Adalia is named after her. She also invited the Harvard football team to her home after they beat Yale. She hosted a boxing match in her home, which, clutch those pearls, scandal. That is such that's so unfeminine. And so not upper class. So, yeah.
I feel a faint coming on.
I know. And men fought. She danced. she had, and this is kind of what I love this look. Can we bring it back? She had two large diamonds attached to wires and wore them bouncing in her hair.
What?
I know. She's just kind of bobbling around with these diamonds, if only. Yeah, so she was completely unconventional. And because of that, and because she has this affinity with these outsiders, her house and her parties become this home and this hub for all of the arts culture in Boston.
Oh my gosh.
She attracted musicians, artists, actors, and she really became a patron. Like, she took her money and she invested it in the art scene of Boston. She became patron of the Boston Symphony, of countless music students. She would just be like, you have talent, let me fund your career. She also invested in the visual arts, and we'll get into some of the artists that she... So that's, like, one of the big things. Yes, we have this museum, but we also have this, like, generational legacy of all these people who were brought through. So that's kind of the cool thing is she did, in some ways, and, you know, she uses her privilege to just spread that wealth.
Which is good.
And give people careers. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. And so she also, you know, this is... Okay, so I don't think I wrote this down, but... she had these nephews that she kind of took in as her own. She injected when their parents died. And so as she was educating them, she was like, gosh, I really wish I knew more. Like, yes, she's been finished or whatever. But she was like, I want to do some more academic work because I'm tutoring these boys. And I'm like, knowledge is cool. So she starts like going. And of course, she's like, I'm going to go to some lectures at Harvard. Like, da 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 da.
Oh, my gosh.
And attend. So she basically started attending the readings of Charles Eliot Norton, who was the first professor of art history at Harvard University ever.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So they became buds, and he invited her to join the Dante Society, which sounds so fun and super secret. But basically, they're collecting rare books and manuscripts, beginning with the early editions of Dante's work. So that's where she starts to become a collector. She starts to be interested in, like, gathering these ancient works. And so her collection really started with ancient manuscripts of Dante.
Wow.
Yeah.
No big deal.
NBD. And so, you know, there's this kind of, like, scandalous thing that she becomes, and this is why the Vice article calls her this collector of men, was because she mostly mentored male artists and male writers. And so there's some of this kind of questions of like, was she not supporting women? But I also have to think, like, it's the Victorian era. Like, there aren't a lot of women in those scenes, not because they're not interested. And so she is like an anomaly in these spaces. And so I don't think she was
allowed to be there.
Yeah, like, I don't think she was anti-woman. I just don't think that there were a lot of women there, which sucks. But I don't think she would have, like, not been a patron.
She wouldn't have, like, turned them away.
I don't think so. And so, like, people sometimes are like, well, why isn't she doing this with women? I'm like, there's not a lot around.
Right.
But she collects these writers, and there were all these scandals, like, does she have these romantic relationships with these artists and things like that. But really, that was kind of like the scandal gossipy papers, and really she kind of saw herself as a patron, which is a very masculine role, you know?
Right.
And so that's why they call her kind of a collector of men. She's collecting these artists and getting into her circles. We have John Singer Sargent, Whistler already, and also the author Henry James. And Henry James actually immortalized her in his 1902 novel, The Wings of the Dove.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Right? Yeah, she's everywhere. The main character, Millie Thiel, wears these trademark pearls that Isabella Stewart Gardner wears that you will see. we'll post it on Instagram, that appear in this famous portrait of her by John Singer Sargent, which we'll talk about later on. So, yeah, she's known for these pearls. And so, although Henry James, he was kind of a jerk to her, though. He liked hanging out with her, but he thought she was kind of dumb. And so he would, like, diss her a lot. And she was like, I know what you're doing. I'll let you in my circle, but, like, don't be so rude.
Okay, Lynn, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just really quickly. Are you telling me that a famous male author from the Western Canyon, canon, was maybe not the swellest of guys.
And maybe a little patronizing? Surprise.
A little bit sexist?
I'm gonna
clutch my pearls again.
I know. But you can see, like, and I'm sure that's the thing, though, is, like, she's in these circles and she's probably navigating a lot of douchey people.
Right.
But you don't really hear about that much. You really hear about her playfulness. Like, there is this really fun story of her and the painter John Singer Sargent, like, playing tag down a hallway. Like, she is playful and fun. Let me see. I'm trying to just kind of go through here. We can skip some scandals that are just like, she might have had a romantic relationship, but we don't think so. Oh, here is a little scandal, though. So John Singer Sargent paints this portrait of her in 1888. Mm. And the likeness of her, it's said to cause a stir because she is wearing her signature pearls, but she's in this low-cut dress.
Oh, my.
Scandal, scandal, scandal. And so people said some unfair things about it that I won't repeat. And actually, her husband got so angry with what people were saying that he withdrew her work. But then after he dies, she puts it in her museum, like, front and center. She's like, here I am.
Yeah.
So I think she's kind of protecting his feelings. But the kind of cool thing is that, like, her husband wasn't at all angry with her for what she was doing, which would have been a very typical reaction at the time. If anything, he was mildly bemused. He was just kind of like, look at her go. I love it. Which I think is great.
Like, this is like a good match for her.
Yeah, he's just like super pleased by everything he does. He's so into the art collecting world with her. So he is just amused and there for the ride.
I love it.
Kind of the last person that she is a mentor for is Bernard Brenson, who becomes her. She like invests in his whole college career. He's an art collector. And then he and her really set off to start collecting a lot of Renaissance art. They go to Florence together. And again, very platonic, very professional. They're on a mission together, art together, and he ends up kind of traveling the world with her. And this is what he wrote about her, which I love. She lives at a rate and an intensity with a reality that makes other lives seem pale, thin, and shadowy.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I like that so much. I want that to be what our lives are like.
They are. Guess what they are. But yeah, she is just like, as much death and sadness as she's experienced, she's also experienced. She is living life to the fullest, maybe even because of that.
Yeah, it would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. So she's full of like this adventure and this spunk, and nobody even knows how to handle it in this world. let's see. I'll kind of zoom through here. But she really starts to think about her museum. And again, it's like, oh, no, I have all this money. But, it's like, so she inherits a lot of millions, $1.75 million in 1891.
Okay.
Yeah, from her father's death. So, naturally, her art collecting expanded. It's a nice way to say it.
Sure.
She's like, cool, okay, I can go do this. And so she... Like, the turning point was when she purchased Rembrandt's self-portrait at age 23.
Oh, right.
Yeah. They were like, we're serious art collectors now. And kind of as we said before, it's kind of a shady, it's a complicated field.
It's a complicated
They decide to enter into it. And they have, they're like, gosh, we have these two houses. Maybe we can, like, start putting our art in them. But they kind of – so they combine their houses, but they realize that they want to buy land and build a build a building that will house all of their art kind of as a museum, but also has apartments for them to live in it. So they're like, let's make our museum mansion dream.
I want to live there.
I know. Yeah, so they start really thinking about this seriously, and they start traveling to Italy, and they are very inspired by Venice. And so in the summer of 1897, they travel through Venice, Florence, and Rome and gather these fragments of architecture.
Oh.
And so the thing that's kind of wild is that it's not like we're going with Roman architecture.
Right.
And we're sticking with that. They get everything that looks cool, which is kind of unheard of. So they're getting Windows, doorways, reliefs, balustrades, capitals, statuaries from the Roman era, the Byzantine era, the Gothic era, and the Renaissance periods. And they're like, we want it all!
Oh my gosh!
So it's amazing. This very, like, postmodern, sorry, that's, like, super snooty to say, but, like, it's just this very, yeah. like, throwing it all together, we don't care, we think it right. looks cool, which is not really what you did.
No, it sounds, I mean, knowing as little as I know about this time period and about art history in general, it seems like that would really not be the way that this yeah. is normally yeah. pursued. Yeah,
it's like, we must preserve, da, da, da. And they're like, it looks cool, throw that arch with that.
I like them yeah. so much.
Oh, it just gets better. So anyways, they're really interested in the Back Bay Fens, which is Fenway, sounds familiar, Fenway Park. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The museum is right by there. And it's kind of, they're interested in this area that has, like, no houses, which I think is just, I'm like, this is so crazy because, like, I, you know, having lived and worked there, it's just the most urban setting ever. Right. And so right. they're like, what is this untouched piece of greenery? And so, yeah, it's like a swamp at the time. And they're like, this looks cool. But the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, the MFA, was going to be built there. And so they, mm-hmm. you know, they think that Jack, especially, he was on the board and he was like, this is going to be an art central area. And so I want to buy land next to it because I think this is going to be the next big cultural hub, spot. Which it was. So yeah, but at that time it was a swamp. So they buy this area and it's right around like an Olmsted Park. You know, it's like, what? Yeah. So anyways, they buy this land, but then another tragedy hits and Jack Gardner, her husband, dies really suddenly of a stroke in 1898. So again, Isabella is in this period of extreme grief. And so she just turns to art again as her way to get out of this grief. So 6 weeks after her husband dies, she purchases that land that they were looking at in the Fens, and she selects an architect to draw plans for the museum. Oh, so she's gosh. Like, I'm gonna move through my grief through building a this monument project. To art.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So she does that, and so this begins the museum building process, which I love. The construction begins kind of right after her husband dies in 1899. It's complete in 1901. William Sears, the architect, would later call her a challenging employer because she wanted to play a much more active role in the construction than his other clients.
Oh,
and
God.
So she would literally come to the job site every day with a little dinner pail.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh,
and she God. Would be, she would like order all the builders around, and they brought in these Italian artisans to do different parts, and she would like yell instructions at them in Italian and things like that.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so and they have these photographs of her standing on a ladder like demonstrating the effect that she wanted in the stucco walls. So she's just like in there like, we're building it. I don't think they had construction hats, but I just imagine her in one.
I imagine her in one. Also, can I just say, yes. Uh-huh. 100%. And I just also want to say, God loved challenging women.
I know, right? Yeah. Like, I think it's awesome. She knows what she wants. And here's my favorite anecdote. So she has this room that I'll tell you about in her museum that I love, but it's called the Gothic Room. We'll just start there.
Okay.
And so the ceiling beams arrived for the Gothic Room. And she says, these are much too smooth. This does not fit my vision for the Gothic room. So she takes an axe and she starts hacking away at them until she has the texture that she wants.
What?
So she's like, stand out of my way. I must build my Gothic room.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
She's a hero.
Yeah. I just love her so much. So let me try to describe to you this amazing place that she built.
And that you've been. You've been there.
Yes, several times. And when this whole pandemic is over, we can go there. And it's yes. beautiful. And also, this is, I was going to say this for later, but if your name is Isabella, you have a lifelong free membership to the museum.
Oh, that makes me want to cry. I don't know why.
I love it really so much. Sweet. Yeah. So any Isabellas out there, you have a lifetime membership. So anyways, I'm going to try to describe this, and it's so hard. But so there's the building centers around an indoor courtyard with like a terrarium sunroof on the top. So you go inside and you immediately feel like you're outside.
Okay.
And there are these four stories and then chambers that kind of wrap around this indoor courtyard.
Okay.
The building includes art galleries, music galleries, a top floor apartment that she lived, a private chapel, also an elevator and a telephone, which at the time was very fancy. Mm. The art critic Robert Campbell describes it really well, and then I'm going to try to continue to describe it. Okay. The Gardner, the museum, is more remarkable than it looks at first. This is a palace that has been turned inside out. The gardener's real facades are the four-story sides of the atrium. And these modeled indoor facades are washed by sunlight that is modulated in such a way that it resembles light reflected off water as it would be in Venice. So I guess what it's mostly known for is this courtyard in which she and Jack have collected these arches, columns, walls, statues from the Roman era, the Byzantine era, the Romanesque era, the Renaissance, and they've put them all together in a garden.
Wow.
And it has fragrant flowers and water features. And so it's supposed to be like a five senses space. You okay. go in and you hear the water, you hear music from the hallways, you smell the flowers, and you are in this world that does not exist anywhere else because it's all of this stuff on top of each other.
Right.
Yeah. And the Gothic room became her personal sanctuary, and it's full of medieval religious relics and that portrait of her by John Singer Sargent. The museum was completed in 1901. She then moved into the fourth floor and devoted herself to arranging the works of art in the galleries. Wow. And this is what she's most known for, is the way that everything is placed. And I think this is such a statement to... This is so much more than I want this picture here. It is... Her agency is in how she places this art. And it is unlike any museum you've ever been in. There are no white walls. It feels much more like a house. And often there are these antique chairs placed right in front of a painting. There are rugs draped over the walls. And many pieces are not accompanied with any information because she wants the viewers to just contemplate the art for its own merit. And you go inside, and so it literally is, it's paintings, sculptures, tapestries, furniture, rare books, manuscripts, and art all over the place.
Wow.
And it's just, and she was very, very, as we will find out, specific about how she wanted everything to be. And the museum includes artwork by Michelangelo, Botticelli, Matisse, Manet, and much more.
Oh my God.
I want to describe this room. This is the writer Liz Lentz. And the museum, it's supposed to give you this overwhelming feeling of experiencing art. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily like, I must look at this painting from here. You're inside it. Mm-hmm. So this author is describing walking through the museum and into this specific room. The arrangement is an enigma. Style, artists, eras, countries collide in every room. Eventually, I found myself alone in the Raphael room. It's a space strewn with religious iconography, white-faced Virgin Marys clinging to their sons. But the centerpiece of the room is Botticelli's The Tragedy of Lucretia. The painting tells the story of a virtuous noblewoman who is raped. Then she commits suicide, taking the narrative of her life into her own hands. The room overwhelmed me. I knew that Isabella's son had only died a few months before he turned two. I had only recently given birth to my son and witnessed a dear friend lose hers. With that constant jerk and slack on the rope of life, loss and gain, I felt like I understood Isabella, and I related to all those pictures of mothers holding their doomed sons.
Oh.
I know. So it is like an emotional space.
Yeah.
And she's kind of tapping into the feelings you are supposed to get by art and not necessarily like, I'm going to stand back. I'm going to be overwhelmed by it.
Right.
So the museum opens in night to the public, private opening in 1903. And so there was a complete concert by the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
Oh.
Of course. She's like, musicians everywhere. And then it opens to the public a month later in February. At the opening, she served champagne and donuts.
Sure. Why not?
Which I love. And perfect. So kind of looking at where it is now, there are over 2,500 objects in the museum, from ancient Egypt to Matisse, sculpture, drawings, glassware, manuscripts. And I love this. This is a quote from her friend Henry Adams. "As long as such a work can be done," and he means the museum, "I will not despair of our age, though I do not think anyone else could have done it. You are a creator and you stand alone." Which I love. Yeah. And here's the thing that is so interesting is that she stipulated in her will that the rooms have to remain exactly as she designed them.
Wow.
And if anyone were to break this rule, she had it that legally the entire museum must be taken apart and donated to the MFA, the Museum of Fine Arts.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So she's like, no one touch anything. She is so intentional with this space.
Yeah.
And there is no other museum like it. And this is so sweet. Her friend Ida Higginson was writing to her, talking about a time before she had created the museum. And she said, "You said to me that if you ever inherited any money that was yours to dispose of, you would have a house filled with beautiful pictures and objects of art for people to come and enjoy. And you have carried out the dream of your youth." Oh. I know. I know.
You're killing me. You're killing me, Morris.
I'm sorry. It's, yeah. Oh. So she's wonderful. I'm okay, here. I'll have some seedy underbellies of art collection. So, or maybe just some people really contend with her idea that, like, she has this very controlled lens of how people remember her. She was famous for burning lots of her letters. Oh. So she reminds me a lot of Hatshepsut here. She really understands the power of memory. And some people, you know, and some people are like, that combined with this, like, saving art imperialism makes her this kind of shady figure. And I don't think we need to throw away the imperialism question, but I don't think there's anything bad about having a controlled lens and being really intentional. I think people do it all the time.
Yeah, I think that's pretty common.
Yeah, and the fact that we would then be critical of that in any way. Right. I'm like, why is the lens, or why are we so critical of it? But anyways,
why are we so critical of a woman that wants to control how she's remembered?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like, do you want to have that story? Do you want to take the reins? I don't think you get to. So anyways, the end of her life. So basically for over the next 20 years, she is filling her museum. And she fills it with visual art, performing artists. She organizes concerts, lectures, and exhibitions. And the kind of funny thing is like she had envisioned that the museum would be free. But when people were coming in, she noticed that they were starting to steal things. And, like, at one point, a woman literally took a scissors out of her pocket and, like, snipped off some of this, like, ancient tapestry.
What?
And so she was like, well, okay, I guess I have to charge a little bit. Which it's like a crappy compromise.
right.
But so she had to kind of dampen her vision of having it be a free space because she was like, it's a free-for-all.
Oh, gosh.
So anyway, but besides that, she brought all of these artists into her home. And, you know, John Singer Sargent ends up painting the Gothic room himself. We have this famous dancer, Ruth St. Denis, dancing the famous Cobra in the Cloisters. I don't know what that is. The Italian opera singer Nelly Melba performed from the balcony of the Dutch room. So this is like a living space for art to experience. So here's her legacy. She died in 1919. She suffered a stroke. She suffered a stroke in 1919. I misspoke. But she continued to she lived through it. She continued to receive guests in the museum for the next 5 years. She died in 1924, and she left the museum for the education and enjoyment of the public forever. She wants to spread it. She's great. But she does have these stipulations. She says, I love this so much. So, yes, she wants everything to be left as it is, or else she would shut it down permanently. And also, she stipulated in her will that her birthday must be celebrated each year in the Episcopalian chapel in the museum.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so she's like, you better remember me. And so they have all this great community work still. There's an artist-in-residence program. They work with elementary schools doing, like, gardening projects and art projects. The museum is still free for youth, and there are lots of discounts for students. And as I said before, if your name is Isabella, you have a lifetime free membership. So that's like the physical legacy, but also as a mentor, she, like I said, she just carried these up and coming artists through to create the art that we know from that next generation. So wow. We wouldn't have so many artists coming from that area had she not taken them under her wing.
Right.
As she died, she also left a ton of money to different zoos, hospital, literary associations, children's associations, all around Boston. And so is this extremely big patron just for the city itself. Wow. She's buried in Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge with her husband and her infant son. And just to leave you with this, her motto through her life, which appears on the door to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, is, "It is my pleasure," in French, "c'est mon plaisir." So that is Isabella Stewart Gardner.
Oh my gosh.
Art goddess, patron saint of Boston, who created my most favorite place in the world. Oh. And someday when this is over, we'll go there.
Oh my God, we have to go there. We must go there.
Yes.
That's going to be our first special Lady Day trip.
Yeah. And so I will put, you know, when we do social media, I'll put, there are these stunning pictures of the courtyard. And I'll try to put some of the, some pictures of her, but some of the, maybe the arrangements, not just the pieces, but like the weird.
Oh, it is.
And it's weird. And sometimes it's uncomfortable and sometimes it's spooky. And sometimes I just remember this one staircase that's just bright blue.
Oh.
So it's this, like, you get to go into this woman's brain.
Oh, what? It's incredible.
That's so I hope you liked the adventure.
I loved the adventure. I'm still crying a little bit.
I know.
It's the second time you've made me cry in the history of the podcast, just for the record.
Tears are good.
Tears are good. Tears are necessary. Mm-hmm. No, that's just, there's just, I don't know. I'm trying to come up with my thoughts here without getting like way more verklempt than I already am, but there's something so, and of course, yes, imperialism's in there, art collecting as like a premise that we need to be careful about. Yeah. Like, all of that's in the conversation. None of that is going to be left out, 100%. But there's something, and maybe right now, especially because we're all in our homes.
Yes, okay. Right? I've been thinking like, about that a lot.
Okay. Yeah. Because I know for me, it's been so important to try to do things to make my space feel a certain way. Right. Yes. And I'm not talking like big like projects. I mean like cleaning in a certain way or like putting photos up in a certain way. And every house that I've lived in my whole life, it's always been the same. Like I want to have these sorts of pictures on the wall. I always want to have things taped up. I always want to have like a creative space. Like it's just, it's the first thing that I do anywhere that makes me feel like I belong in a space.
Yeah.
And until it's done, I just never feel good. Like, it doesn't matter if I've, like, got my bedroom set up, got the kitchen set, like, what? No. Until I have, like, that creative, like, home within my home, I feel like I don't fully belong. So, thinking about that and then thinking about this woman who was like, I'm literally going to take the inside of my mind and I'm going to physically and visually construct it outside of my person.
Yeah.
Is so beautiful.
It's powerful. Right?
It's so powerful. Like, this is what it's like to be in my head. All of it. Right? The grief, the depression, the struggle.
Yeah. And the sexiness.
And the sexiness. Like the scandal, everything. Like, the pleasure of it.
Yeah.
Like, you can't... Like, when you're talking about how she wanted to control the narrative of who she was and how she was remembered, there's that aspect of it for me. But that, and like that, and it's forceful, not like in an aggressive way, but it's like, I'm going to like impress this upon you. I'm taking a stance. But then, like, the greater stance to me is that she's like, come into this space and you cannot escape my thoughts.
Yeah.
Like,
and you have to like move through them.
This is all of it, and you will get no like respite.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's, like, that's, oh, I love that so much.
It is, it's so cool. And just, and the fact that was so, I mean, it's still unusual.
Yes.
Yeah. And, like, Yeah, I've been thinking about it a lot as I literally move all of my things. And
right,
like
right.
The assertion of self in space. And
right.
Yeah, these like objects that become these kind of relics of your life.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and how strong it is to be like, no. Oh, something I didn't even get to talk about though is the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum has one of the most famous art robbery stories of all time.
Ooh.
And I'll tell that's for a later time. I was like, I can't include it because it's after she died. But the thing that I love is that there's a great drunk history about it, actually, which is a great way to consume that narrative. They left, like, as per her wish, there are just empty spaces where the
used to be. Oh, I like that so much. Don't know why.
And like, it's part of the history of it. They're not trying, it's just like, and they're gone. And some of the art still has not been recovered, which I think is wild. I'm like, let's become sleuths. Let's become spook sleuths.
Spook sleuths, sound sleuths, art sleuths. We're ready to go. We're ready to be hired.
And go find these pieces of missing art.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh, that's so amazing, Caitlin. Caitlin, so, thank you. It just like so got glad. Me right.
I'm so glad.
Right in my heart. And just, I don't know, just something about, especially like with her battling depression and the way that like she worked through it, you know, I don't know. It's not that there, again, can you, not to say there's a right way to work through depression. I'm not, you know, like everyone's going to handle it their own way. But it's just,
it's so life powerful. Affirming. To the 10,000th degree.
Yes. 5,000,000%. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. Two women, both from New York, living very different lives.
But so amazing lives. This Incredible. Is our second all New York episode. We had
New York.
We had Maria Tallchief. And
Yes. And the librarian.
So anyways.
New York, what's happening? You're very special. We keep coming back to you.
Yeah.
That's incredible. That's going to keep me going for a few days.
I'm so
that's
glad.
That's for sure.
I have been, you know, so this is advice that one of my friends gave me a long time ago when I moved and was not feeling great. I've had a lot of moves where I don't feel great about it. I've had some where I feel great, but and the reason why we don't feel great about this, I've come to terms with it, is just that we didn't really have a choice.
Yeah.
And she gave me some really good advice that she was like, when you move into a new space, bring your paintings first.
Hmm.
Bring your art first and lay it against the empty walls and it'll start to feel like your home.
Yes.
And that's what we did.
It's so smart.
Yeah.
It's so smart. Yeah. I know I already kind of talked about this, but for me, I always have like a folder. I collect like notes. Like, I actually, as you were talking about this, I was, like, looking over my shoulder because I have notes and quotes from you, like, on my bulletin board.
That's awesome. I feel so honored.
Yeah. My favorite Caitlin Morris quote, that it's written in my own handwriting. It's on a post-it note. It's from a graduate office. And the quote is, "You are also a tough woodland creature covered in glitter." It's something that you said one time that really got to me. But I, like... I kind of, I guess similar to the art thing, whenever I'm moving, I like carefully peel these things off of the wall. Like, okay, the tape is taking the paint off. I should probably stop using tape. I never will. And I like, and I always put them in just like a peachy like folder.
Yes.
And then I'll like get in my new space. I'll sit down. And I'll be like, okay, where do I tape up all the random ass notes that I have?
That's so important.
And like, I've thought about that before that like, you know, someday when I die and they go through my things, they'll be like, why does she just have so much paper?
That's a perfect question.
It's just paper. It's just quotes that don't make any sense except to her.
Or maybe they'll make perfect sense to someone of a new generation who needs to hear that they're a woodland creature.
Covered in glitter. Yes. Okay. This is amazing. I know we have to wrap things up. But
super fast. Special shout out, super fast.
Special. That's it. Yeah. And I've got one and I'm just going for it.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see if I can do this without crying again.
Oh
JK,
my gosh.
I can't. But I'm just going to do a very personal special lady shout out to my sister. She is back in school, back in college.
Yay!
after a bit of a break, and she just freaking nailed her midterm, and she's so smart. I mean, there's no surprise to me. She's so smart. It's kind of bizarre how brilliant she is. But she's completely nailing it, and I'm really proud of her.
Good job.
Keep it up, little sister. You're doing it. Yeah. She's also like, you know, an adult. When I say little sister, she's like, you know, 25. So fully grown. But yeah. I'm just really, really proud of her. So
that's awesome.
All you students out there that are fucking still taking classes right now, good job.
I know. Good job. It's so hard, and they're doing so well. And this is actually my special lady shout out. I just got permission today from one of my students to shout her out. I'll keep her anonymous for many legal and privacy reasons.
Sure.
But I was having a little bit of a slump last week.
Okay.
Moving was really is hard.
Of
navigating
course.
All of that. With a lot of pets and teaching online, and there's a pandemic. There's just a lot going on.
Don't know if you've heard
of
it. And
I started to feel really overwhelmed last week. And when I feel overwhelmed, let me tell you, my inbox starts to pile up. And I stop responding to people as quickly as I normally would.
Yes.
And this student had been emailing me for a while, like, hey, can we meet up? I'm having trouble with homework. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. And I didn't respond. And so I saw this little email reply, and the first line was like, I haven't heard from you, which normally is like a passive aggressive or a aggressive email.
Yeah.
It's like, where are you? Da 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 da. I get a lot of commands from my students. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to open this email and just, I haven't responded to her. It's my bad. Let me see how I can fix it. And then it proceeded to be, I haven't heard from you, and I just wanted to make sure you're okay. And this is a really hard time, and I know that you have a lot going on, you know, because I told my students, like, my cat's sick, and I'm moving, so I might not be as responsive. And she was like, and this is where I might cry. She was like, I just wanted to see how you're doing, and I, like, here, I know you really like little animals, so here's a puppy video and a 15-minute meditation.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. And like, bless I don't expect her. My students to care about my well-being.
Absolutely
but like
not.
It was so kind and so forgiving, and it made me, maybe I burst out into tears because I needed that so badly.
I might burst
but
out
it was
tears.
Just so it was so like something I'm really trying to remember through all this is like how human this experience is we're all going through.
Yes
And we're all having these human reactions, and we're not these productivity robots. And it's so hard to navigate because, you know, part of our livelihoods and our students' jobs to pass a class is being productive. And suddenly that's really hard. And how do we balance that? And so trying to remember the human side of it all. And here was this student who was doing a better job than me at remembering it and just wanted to reach out and see if I was okay. So anyways.
That's wonderful.
She's my special lady.
Oh my gosh.
It just made me feel paid attention to in a way that I didn't need, but was very nice.
Seen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Or cared for.
Cared for. Thought of. Oh, so thoughtful. How lucky are we to have these special ladies in our lives?
I know. Yeah.
Man.
It was so cool.
Ugh.
And I was just like, this person is going to go far.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, with that kind of compassion.
With that kind of compassion. Wow. I don't even know how to wrap it up today because I'm so emotional still. You know, I'm like, what are the final words? And any other things? Oh, yes,
can
go
I,
for it.
Can I do some
please.
Really silly final words? Not silly.
Yes.
I just keep forgetting to say at the end of our things. Of course, you can follow us on social media, but you can also sign up for, we send out little emails every time an episode goes out, and it's basically like me playing around with email templates.
Okay.
Having a lot of fun.
Listeners, if you haven't received the Special Lady Day email, you need to know that Caitlin's last email that she sent out, because it's all Caitlin. I have not once penned even a word of the email. Do I say that I'm going to learn how to do it? Yes. Do I ever follow up? No, I don't.
It's okay.
It's a thing we're working on together. But no, Caitlin is doing an amazing job. And your last email, I laughed out loud. It was so cute and funny. I loved it. Producer Chad loved it. Eric loved it. So, okay, maybe a, like, slightly biased crowd, but still.
It was fun. You
sign up for the emails. They're so cute.
Yeah, so we have those. And we have, like, it's a hearty list of people who, like, get them, but I just realized I'd never put it out there that you can do that. And
how do you sign up for the email?
You go to our website.
That's right.
And there's, like, there's a contact. Or, no, you can, the first thing you can do is fill out a little form to, like, sign up for our newsletter. And you can always unsubscribe if it's annoying you. Yes. But it's few and far between.
Yeah, you're not going to get a bunch from
us. And maybe I forget to do one for an episode. So it's like two months in between. But there's that. There's social media. And also, if you want to email us your special lady shout outs.
Oh, always.
Go anytime. For it. Always or welcome. Or suggestions or things we would love to hear from you. So anyways, those are just there, and I always forget to say it.
No, that's great. Rate, review, subscribe.
Give us those little stars. Oh, I love getting stars.
Listen, I can maybe speak for Caitlin too. I'm wildly type A and could pretty much turn my entire life around with a sticker chart. So if you throw some stars at me, yes, it'll go to my head, but it will be so encouraging.
Oh, and last but not least, we have all these new listeners from Mexico. And
yes!
How cool. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being here. We see you. We're going to put out a post in a little bit saying hi.
So amazing. So anyways, we love it.
Yeah, I just wanted to say welcome. It's so cool to see people from all over. And that little uptick in surge was such a wonderful, happy surprise. And like, you guys, you literally like kept listening to our episodes. I was like, they'll listen to one and not, because sometimes that happens.
Sure.
And it was like, no, I'm gonna like listen to a couple. So that was really sweet.
We appreciate it so much. It's such a cool thing to imagine. It's such a cool thing to imagine.
And especially like we're all far away. I'm like, what are you doing? Tell me about your life.
Oh my God, please tell us about your lives. We're so excited. That's amazing. What a special.
You guys are special people.
Very special people. All of you. All of the people that have supported us this whole way. We've got a couple of months before this will be totally official, but Caitlin and I are really sneaking up on our 1-year anniversary of this podcast. Yes. And it's going to be a special episode.
Is news to me. I'm so excited.
It might be news to you, but I'm letting you know it will be special.
I'm so excited.
So that's really exciting, too. We'll take any excitement we can get, right?
Monument moment.
Oh. What?
This is Say the last episode we're going to record in my first recording studio.
Oh, my gosh. And it's the
thank the room. Like in Marie Kondo, you thank your object for what it's done to you. So we're thanking this room. We're moving on. My next apartment is old, so it's wall-to-wall carpet, baby.
Perfect.
Yeah, but there will be a window, and I'm very excited about having a window.
Absolutely. Also, as you remember, the very first episode we ever released, we recorded together in person at your apartment in that room.
That's little really did sweet. We know that was the last time we'd be together in the space. This is the kind of thinking I do that is
don't do it.
Horrible for transitions.
No. I go, we're coming
this
back
is
out.
The last time we'll do this ever in our life, and I'll look at that thing. So that's how I'm nailing this transition.
Yeah, and it's fine. We all have our. It's fine. We all have our tactics. We all have our tactics. Mine involve watching an very surprising amount of The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills and then accidentally getting into Vanderpump Rules, but that's for another episode.
Okay. Well, we don't you know talk what we do today. And we're going on and on, but we always find ourselves rewatching The Office when we move, because I think it's this really surprising source of stability in our lives.
Oh yeah,
so we're like, let's watch that and feel comforted. So every time we've moved, we'll just like
put it on,
pick a season and keep going, and so that's what's getting us through.
I love it. Okay, well,
now that we're really off topic, we love you.
Now that we're really, we love you a lot. Everybody, please, please take as much as you can extra good care of yourselves right now. Take care of each other. Mm-hmm. Please stay safe. Wear the mask. I know it's annoying, but it's so important. Let's all take a note from the special lady shout outs and be kind to each other, because it's better than the alternative. And maybe most importantly, as you come to the smooth jazz ending of Special Lady Day podcast. I don't know why this is how we talk now, but it is.
It is.
Caitlin Morris.
I can't do it. I just growl.
I had a bit of a time in radio, and this is the only thing I took from it. No. Caitlin Morris, mm-hmm. I love you very much.
I love you, Jessica Lohafer.
Yes. Finally. Okay. All right. Bye.
Bye.